Everybody, you're quickly going to realise it's morning for us, and we're going to tell you all about it in a second, but it's good morning, good afternoon, good evening. How are you getting on? I'm Ian, and welcome to the Alcohol Uncensored podcast, episode 32, which I co-host with the fabulous founder of the community, Kelly Cooney. Good morning, Kelly. How are you getting on?
I'm good, Ian. How are you this morning?
I'm all right, actually. I was up at 5:30, just dropping that in there, you know, and did what I needed to do, and got myself ready for our fabulous call this morning with a great guest who's from overseas. So yeah, we're just so people know it's 7 o'clock in the morning. That's what we're trying to get in, isn't it, Kelly? That it's 7 o'clock in the morning here in here in the UK.
And I'll apologise in advance for probably not being able to find my words. I was outside with a sick dog at 1:30 this morning. Sick dog was still able to chase fox. So it's been an eventful night, but happy to be here.
Yeah, is he all right? Is he going
to? Yeah, I'll get him to the vets this morning. Yeah, he's not great. He's not a bit of an upset tummy, so I'll get him to the vets this morning. But he'll be fine. He'll be fine.
Well, I hope so. We're up early this morning because our guest is in Japan, and so we need to work with the relevant sort of time zones, if you like. So today we've got with us David Dean Haskell. Good morning, David. How are you getting on?
Good morning, Ian. I'm doing great, and it's not as difficult for me. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon here, so thank you guys for getting up so early to accommodate. It's harder to figure out between Asia and Europe. Asia and the United States is a lot easier. East Coast, West Coast kind of fits in, but it's always some kind of a challenge for us to put these things together, so I really appreciate it, and I'm really excited to be here. So.
You're quite all right. We were keen to speak to you, so it works well for us as well. And it gets it done, if you know what I mean. So it works well for us. It means that another evening at some point is going to be free that we would normally be recording. So it's absolutely fabulous. David is the author of a book entitled Wounded Angels, which is a memoir about trauma, grief, addiction, recovery, inner child work, and rebuilding an authentic voice. And we've been having a look at it between Kelly and I, and we're really quite excited to get into this topic because it's coming at things from a really different angle. It's something that we haven't really covered before. It was released last year, and I think David's got a really sort of unique and interesting story that I think is going to help us sort of talk about all of that. So without further ado, David, do you mind just telling us a little bit about you, a bit about sort of your current life, if you know what I mean, and then we can maybe rewind and go back to sort of where things might have started for you.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you. So currently I'm writing. So I've been writing fiction and nonfiction. The fiction I've been writing for a long time. So I published my first book back in 2013. So I've been at it for a while as a writer, but I never wrote nonfiction. I wrote four sci-fi books while I was still deep in the addictions, deep in the alcohol, deep in the codependency. And, you know, like I joke about thinking about Stephen King doing interviews and saying he never remembered writing Cujo. And I think that's kind of like where I was at. You know, I was like, I look back at my books and I'm proud of them, but I was struggling. And I was like, writing was about the only thing I could do. I was really a hermit, stuck indoors, denying that I was, you know, I was just dying. You know, I mean, that was near the end of a really decades long nightmare of addiction. And so, yeah, after that, when I finally was able to get sober, that was in 2018, I suddenly had a writer's block. So 5 years when I was doing the spiritual and emotional healing and recovery, I couldn't write anymore. And I was like, oh, great. You know, what am I supposed to do now? You know, I was like, should I quit? Should I, you know, because I was really trying, but I think I just didn't have the bandwidth to do anything creative because I was doing recovery, right? And that was enough for anybody. But then finally in 2024, right around the start of the year, I was just, the floodgates opened and I was writing again. And I wrote, the sci-fi book that I published this year first, but then all of a sudden I started writing the inner child work that I'd been doing. So I'd been doing inner child as part of the recovery for years, and I wasn't writing it. I mean, journaling, yeah, but not writing, but it just kind of started writing itself. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to write nonfiction. I don't want to be on podcasts and talk about recovery. I don't want to do any of that stuff. You know, I want to write sci-fi and be a New York Times bestseller. But anyway, I wrote that, and now I'm just trying to figure out how to juggle between fiction and nonfiction, talk about healing, talk about the future, talk about past. I mean, that's all of the kind of stuff that I've been into. and I'm happy to be into it, and I'm really glad to be on in a place like this where we can have these conversations and talk about this stuff that really saved my life. And so, at this point, what I'm doing now is continuing the recovery, having conversations about it, writing about it, and doing the business of writing as well.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
Do you mind just going right back to the start, Dave, and just talking about maybe talking about your childhood, if that's okay, and just sort of kind of what started to bring you to where you are now? And clearly, you're sort of coming out the other end, if you know what I mean. But from what I'm sort of picking up, what I've read, you kind of you've had some things quite tough. Do you mind just talking a bit about that, please?
Sure. Yeah, it was rough. It was a lot rougher than I was even able to admit, or like, I always tried to kind of downplay it and say, oh, everybody has their own problems, whatever. But I lost my mom when I was 4 years old. She passed away. So, that's devastating in itself. And I was pretty much broken from that. And actually the whole family really disintegrated. My grandparents divorced. The stepfather who was she had married disappeared. Playmate cousins were gone. It was just like, nuclear bomb went off when I was 4 years old. And then the more devastating fact of that I didn't learn until I was nine was that she had taken her own life, which traumatized, shocked, and shamed me to a degree that I didn't understand or couldn't cope with at the time. I was 9 years old, right? And now I look back and I see all these like this flood of emotions, this toxicity, this trauma that hit me. Just felt like the worst thing, the worst day of my life, which that's how Wounded Angels starts. That's the book starts talking about that trauma. And so it just broke me. It just, I felt like unlikable and unlovable to begin with, because I was already being bullied. I was always already struggling. But then it was like, oh, well, what am I going to do now? What kind of a kid has his mother kill herself? What kind of a kid, everybody must be right. You're not likable. You're not lovable. There's something really wrong with you. I don't know what it is, but I get confirmation about it all the time. And so I just really internalized this idea that I was abrasive and, difficult and a problem and no good and et cetera. And then things got rough even around the I ended up leaving home when I was 14. There was some other stuff went down. A lot of stuff went down. And then things kind of calmed around high school. And I got into music. Music kind of saved me for a while, but then the addiction started to set in around college, around 18, 19 years old. And I know I was listening to one of the podcasts. I know Kelly, you said you got a bit of a later start as well, right? I think for me, I didn't, although my dad, he was alcoholic too, untreated. And he used to give me alcohol when I was 12, 11 years old, inappropriate stuff like that. So I always had a really bad and inappropriate and unhealthy relationship with substances. And then that sort of took over the music, took over school, took over everything, and then really just took over my life for a long, long time.
Wow.
Just listening to you there, David, my heart actually hurt when I think of that 9-year-old boy having to deal with all those emotions and not knowing how to deal with them or what they are. It actually hurt my heart when I was listening to you. Sorry you had to go through that.
Thank you. And the thing, and thank you so much for saying that. And that's the sort of thing that I couldn't even say to myself, because I looked back at that kid and I was, oh, he was no good. He couldn't even get along. But it's like that poor kid. And this is went to the inner child work, totally went to the inner child work, getting in touch with that kid and loving him and understanding like you didn't deserve that. You had nothing to do with that. And all these facets of the inner child that for everyone that gets stuck in a trauma, we tend to look at that and sort of judge it and judge ourselves. But the truth is, when we go through that kind of a trauma, there's nothing to do except make peace with the fact that it wasn't your fault, right? And that's it. When you start talking about people getting into addiction and these kinds of things, I did harm as an adult in addiction. These are things I had to do my best after I was able to get sober to start making up for some of those things. So I'm no saint. I'm no angel. And I thought the title Wounded Angels, I was like debating. It's even in the book, like, should I even, I'm not trying to call myself an angel, whatever, I'm no angel. But the children are, as you
Church.
said, your heart goes out to that 9-year-old, mine too. And it's like, yeah, that was a wounded angel. That's a child. The children never deserve that kind of thing. And it happens so often too.
Right. Just tell us a bit about, so you've said that you sort of that you enjoyed music as a sort of slightly older child. Where did life take you beyond there to sort of, where did you get to the point, Dave, where you thought, you know what, I've got to do something about this? What was the story like from that sort of young child to when you actually started to think, I need to turn this around. I need to start thinking about what's going on here and start addressing and doing the inner work. But what was that story like?
Oh yeah. So, well, the music, I was a professional musician for, I still am. I did some really awesome coaching clinics in Indonesia last year with a bunch of awesome kids, drummer kids. I played drums at Disneyland for a long time. That was a huge part of my life. But originally, I started with piano, and what it was I didn't really like the piano, but I was able to play at school, like in third grade, and kind of get the bullies off my back and like sort of be, oh, Haskell, he's okay, he can play piano, So like for me, that was a protective thing. It's like, oh, if I'm a good musician, I can earn safety, I can earn the right to be like kind of in the crowd if I'm like entertaining people. And so, it kind of it started in a bit of a toxic way, really. But I mean, for me, music has always been a way to be heard and express myself, just like writing, and now just like these conversations. But I guarantee you, I could not have had this conversation even 2 years ago. You know
Right.
what I mean? Like, most of my life, I wasn't able to have a conversation like this. So I was trying to do it through music, trying to do it through substances, because then I could kind of let loose. So many people with alcohol issues found early on that, hey, I'm popular at the bar if I'm drinking, and drinking, kind of did a lot for me for a while until it didn't, until all that stuff went away, right? So there was the drinking too, and then the writing too. It was always me trying to have a conversation that I thought that I could never have, and I couldn't find people that would listen.
So how old were you when you started to sort of to decide that actually enough was enough? There was a lot going on in there that you needed to start to sort of unpick and do the work on yourself. How old were you at that point?
Yeah, it took a while. I was a slow learner. I'll tell you, I dropped out of college and wound up in a psych ward when I was like 24, 25 years old, and everybody was telling me that I had a problem except me. So I mean, there's a woulda, coulda, shoulda in life, right? Like, what if in my 20s I had gotten sober, but I didn't. And I promptly forgot that hospitals and recovery existed, and I just went on to a really illustrious drinking career in Japan, where you can really get away with a lot in Japan. People, it's a drinking culture. You can buy alcohol 24/7. You can get away with bad behavior. So I just kept going until my mid-40s, and things got darker, and I lost all the music jobs. I lost my family, basically. I didn't have any friends. I was really a hermit for the last like 11 years of that. Hadn't worked it didn't wasn't working at Disneyland anymore or anything like that. And I just was kind of like had given up. I'd really failed at life. And again, this is all in the book too. It's a really, kind of depressing to think about that. But in the end, around age 47, things started to get even worse. I took a trip to America. Back where drugs were available, so I could add drugs to the alcohol and all that kind of stuff. I really was spinning out in a more physically dangerous way. I was already 100 pounds heavier and in really, really terrible physical health. But things just got really scary bad to the point where I started realizing I'm gonna die. This is gonna kill me. And then I was I had a psychiatrist tell me that I was psychotic. So I was confirmed psychotic, right? It was like I was wandering around Tokyo trying to find the hospital, like calling her and over because I was so confused. And I know the city. And I just, at the time, I had finally had enough, and I guess I knew where to go. And I sought help, professional help and recovery community help, and I started addressing the problem. It wasn't my last drink. I did have one more relapse, and it was a nasty one a year later. And then in 2018, that was my last drink, and then starting the recovery process. But again, like the codependency still had its hold on me, and I was still like making gods out of people. And like, this was just as much a drug as alcohol, honestly. And it was another 3 years before I could really address that and start doing inner child work. So it was a long road, to say the least.
Can you talk a little bit about the codependency, please, David? Could you share a little bit about
Sure.
that?
Absolutely. A lot of people don't know or aren't as familiar with it. The thing, you can get addicted to anything. You guys know that. And you can do addiction hopping too. People can go from, whatever, from alcohol to drugs to gambling to food to whatever. And people addiction is one of those things. And for me, I had no self-esteem. Not low self-esteem. No self-esteem or negative self-esteem. He's a bad guy. He's no good. So I would attach myself to somebody who could control my life. I would be compliant and I would be with a controller and that would be my hero. I'd be their buddy and I'd be like, "Well, tell me what to do." And like if I followed what they said and they were pleased with me, then I felt like I was okay. But if they weren't happy with me, then I wasn't happy with myself. I didn't have any personal integrity. I didn't have any sense of like my own spiritual nature, my own emotional nature. I was just sort of addicted to that, relationship, addicted to people. And so that really retarded my recovery for a few years because I was getting better, but still I was like struggling so much with that. And again, that goes to the trauma too. That goes to inner child stuff because I know if you read the Codependence Anonymous book, they talk about inner child in that book. It's quite different than the AA book or and a lot of the other recovery books. The Codependence Anonymous addresses inner child. It addresses being the loving reparenting yourself, loving inner parent, and all that kind of stuff. And so I hadn't even really heard about that stuff, and I never really. And the first time somebody mentioned codependency to me, I was like, "Oh, that's a stupid made-up word." I never heard because of course, my resistance, right? It's like, "No way, I'm not going to be that." It's bad enough I had to quit drinking. You want me to quit, the addiction of people too? I can't.
It's so interesting, and I think a lot of our listeners will be intrigued with it because I think a lot of the time when you remove alcohol from your life, even if you haven't got to the point of addiction where you've started to lose things and lose yourself, I think regardless of that, you start to do a bit of work in yourself. You start to be open-minded to all these things and start looking back at your life. So I think it'll be, I think our listeners will be really intrigued. I know I am.
It's the first time I've come across the term, to be honest with you, David. It's
Really?
new to me. Yeah,
Interesting.
it's being something that is kind of a given a title. I can understand how every relationship's got a kind of balance, hasn't it? If you know what I mean. And I suppose that, and I'm probably going. I'm no specialist, David, as you're quickly going to realize. But I imagine a balanced relationship relies on two people being relatively equal in terms
It
of.
does. It does. Yes, absolutely. And that's what codependency is. And just like there's different degrees of unhealthy relationships with alcohol, you've got some people that maybe drink a little too much on a Friday, right? And they're going to be okay, right? Then you get some people who start to really have a problem, and it's affecting their lives. Then you've got some people who ended up in the gutter, like me, And if you end up in the gutter, then you kind of have no choice but to address it. But there's different degrees of codependency too. There's like it's you could just call it like toxic behaviors in relationship, manipulative things, controlling things, but also walking on eggshells, being compliant. These kinds of things are also part of it. It's kind of a dance that we do. But the thing is, I don't believe there's any sort of one way codependent relationship. I think it takes two to tango, and it's very much like a water seeks its own level kind of thing. You always hear about people. An alcoholic and their enabler, and they'll go down, 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 and then suddenly, when the alcoholic quits, that's when the marriage breaks up. That's when the friendship ends. It seems so weird, right? It doesn't seem to make much sense. But the thing is, you're growing unhealthier together, in a way, and it's comfortable, it's
Yes.
familiar, and that kept me in a marriage for far too long because it was very codependent. My marriage, I finally only divorced in 2024, which is the first chapter of my follow-up book, which is coming. So, I mean, it's a lifelong process, right? But the thing is, when you do start addressing relationship addiction, or what, you know, whatever you want to call it, unhealthiness in relationships, then the new relationships you form start out healthier, and the relationships that you're repairing can get healthy if both people are working and growing together. But if one person is kind of stay in one place, then it generally tends to go away. And yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess the secret of a good relationship is that you bring the best out in each other, where what you're talking about there is you're almost bringing the worst out in each other, kind of thing, because there's that sort of really balance.
Right. And that's bringing the best out with each other, right? Is that's a support. It's not codependent. We're not depending and pushing each other down and leaning on each other so much that we're weighing each other down. Instead, we're supporting and lifting, right? But not controlling either, right? Because it's not bringing out the best in me if you tell me what to do. It's bringing out the best in me if you encourage me, and then, you know, maybe I ask you for help and you give me some feedback, but I'm free to disagree, you know, because I'm my own person. These kinds of things are the hallmark of healthy relationships, and yeah, that's what I aim for these days, hopefully.
It sounds like your recovery really kind of started to take off when you addressed this addiction you uncovered of codependency. How did you find that awareness? How did you uncover that?
People told me. People were like, "David, you're codependent as hell." And I was like, "No, I'm not." You know, same thing as with the alcohol. Everybody else was telling me that I had an alcohol problem, but I was like, "No, it's the only good thing in my life." You know, that's the typical delusion, right? This is the only thing that I can count on. It's the only thing that's keeping me afloat, but actually it's the thing that's dragging us under the water. It was the same thing. And it was just another level of needing to peel the onion and, you know, get somewhere else. And a lot, I've heard a lot of people in recovery that have similar issues. It's not something that's that easy to address right off the bat, because if you're just getting sober, or if you're just coming off drugs, you got to just deal with that for a while. You got to make sure that you don't relapse. You got to make sure that you're, you know, doing the right things to get off the substances, because as we all know, that's what's going to kill you the fastest. Or the, you know, same thing with a compulsive overeating or something like that. Those kinds of things can really kill you fast. And these other codependency can kill you too. I certainly felt despondent enough and almost, you know, really ready to end it, because I was just so unwell and unhealthy even after quitting drinking. And I was like sober for years, but I still like felt miserable every day, so, because that was still dragging me down. So, I mean, it can kill you, but certainly these kinds of things you can address over time, but not right away. And it took me, so I'm coming up on, so eight years next month, I will have no drinks in me. And the codependency I've been at, and the inner child thing I've been at for maybe 5 years or so. And, you know, it takes time, which nobody wants to hear. And it takes a lot. It's not easy. It's painful, which nobody wants to hear, but that's what it is.
This is the thing we talk about quite often as well, because obviously through addiction, you, like you said, you hurt people, you make mistakes, and you bring so much more guilt into your life. And the whole point of us having the Alcohol Uncensored as a community is to try and help people that are questioning the relationship with alcohol to remove it now before they start kind of losing themselves, making mistakes, having all that guilt and kind of shame that comes with addiction. And quite often in the community as well, as much as people are in alcoholics or addicts, it's still difficult for them, and it's still difficult to deal with those emotions when they remove alcohol from their life. And we quite often see that, as much as it's a long journey when someone's been deep in alcoholism, but it's really difficult even removing alcohol from your life in a world where alcohol is just engrossed in everything that we do. And it's like sitting with those emotions and being able to talk about them is so important, even at that stage.
Absolutely. Oh, definitely. Yeah, no doubt. And I think, you know, the recovery process allows for that. The thing is, I would only caution people to be very aware of the people that you're relying on. And, you know, trust people who are trustworthy. But you, the thing is, another thing with codependents and in addicts and the rest is that, well, for me anyway, I can only speak for myself really. I would really quickly latch on to you if I thought you were a nice person, Kelly, and I trusted you and you seemed okay. I would spill out my whole story. I would tell you, you know, I really need your help. And then I would like do anything to sort of like try to get an alliance or some kind of friendship going on because I had so much trouble, forming bonds and forming friendships. So I would overshare and I would overextend and sort of and burden people. And I've felt that the other way too. It's, because we're so desperate when we quit. Good God, like so many people are at the bottom. If you're not at the bottom, you're heading that way. So, you're looking for a solution. But the thing is, if you start getting tangled up with people that might not be as healthy as you might think themselves, and they're not really focusing on their own lives, then you can get into these kind of codependent things, which can be toxic.
What I also find quite interesting is, am I right in thinking you were writing the fiction books when all this was kind of going on as well, David? Have I got that right? You were writing it.
I was writing them when I was still actively drinking and doing drugs. And then I had that long writer's block. So I didn't really write anything until about 2024. So I really had to address the alcohol and the codependency head on. And I wasn't really doing much creatively. And then I started writing again in 2024. So it was kind of when I was a bit on the other side of things, I think. I'd say the biggest recovery years for me were probably 2020 and 2021.
Because it sounds like almost the stopping drinking and the recovery from that almost then allowed all this to come out, if you like. And it sounds like suddenly you've had this flood of, and I'm sorry again, I'm going to describe this badly, I apologize, but you have this sort of flood of a self-awareness, and suddenly almost like it's so cathartic, I imagine, that you can then get it down in writing and you can actually get it all out of you. And it sounds like that's then going to be for the benefit of readers who have similar sort of situations and issues. Have I got that right? Is that how it's kind of has it worked like that?
Well, yes and no. I did do a lot of writing, recovery writing. This isn't published. And that kind of that when I was in 2020, 2021, I was writing, I was doing like, inventories and doing that kind of thing and doing self-awareness exercises and gratitude lists and all these kinds of things to try to build myself up a little bit with the help of some people, some really good people that I trusted and were helping me. But I wasn't writing anything for publication. And it was all probably so, I mean, it was such a maelstrom of shit. It's like it wouldn't be anything anybody could decipher even. But it was all coming out. It was all coming out. It was starting to address all these things that had been there for decades. And so when I finally started writing something that was something to be published, I was on the other side of, I wasn't on the other side of everything, but I was in the process at that point of doing regular inner child work. So that has to do with like if you get triggered in a regular. So the example that I use is, if Kelly and Ian went off to dinner and didn't invite me, right? I might feel like hurt and disappointed. That's an adult reaction. But if I stamp my, if I just go, oh, I can't believe again, nobody ever invites me. People, I'm of course because they hate me because I suck. No. If you really just explode with this kind of seems like an overreaction. I have found that goes to like root traumas of abandonment, rejection, the kinds of things that I couldn't contend with when I was 9, 10, 11 years old and my peers were rejecting me and I was just, just really lost and broken. And so when that happens, I have these techniques and really simple techniques and I just connect with the inner child and find that a bit, the person who was rejected, the kid that was rejected. And start sort of bonding with my own self. And so I was doing that work for years. I was doing that work from about 2020, late 2021, 2022, 2023 on me almost a daily basis, probably. And then, as I say, it started writing itself in 2024. So it was already pretty solidified. But also, I think it was also starting to make sense in a linear way. So that's why the book kind of makes a lot of sense because it goes from that 9-year-old all the way through like all these different things that had happened to me and how I was addressing them in real time. So I think it's just sort of a chronicle of the work, but it wasn't the really messy beginning stuff. It's more like the ongoing stuff.
How do you sort of obviously you've almost used yourself as a case study in terms of dealing with that, looking into the inner child, dealing with the trauma, dealing with what you went through when you were younger. But How did you learn the sort of the science, for want of a better word, behind all of that, so that you could then apply it to yourself, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I really didn't. I did it in a very primitive fashion. I was like, it's kind of started. It kind of, well, as I say that okay. So that 9-year-old boy, the one, the when my father told me that my mother had taken her own life, it was the next day in school that I remember. I was sitting there in school and I was feeling floods of shame and fear and dread. What are the kids going to think of me? What's going to happen to me now? What's wrong with me? What will I do? That moment was so traumatizing that I never forgot it. It was always really clear. So when I started doing inner child work, it was kind of easy to tap into that one because it was a memory that just got burned into my soul, a very defining part of me. So some people struggle with the inner child work. They don't really, it seems kind of weird or whatever, and they don't know what they're looking for, and they think, oh, I'm just supposed to imagine myself as a child or whatever. But there is a technique to it, which I did learn, and I'm not, I'll send you the name of the person whose technique it is, because it's not my technique, but it's really a simple technique, which is you start out and you in that triggered situation where you guys went off to dinner and you told me, David, we don't want to have dinner with you, you're no fun at all or whatever, and you guys were so mean to me, and I got triggered. And then, so in that moment, if I want to try to do the inner child work, what I would do is start to express in the third person everything that I'm feeling and thinking. So, like, he can't believe that they went to dinner without him. He's so upset. His stomach hurts now. He wants to punch a wall. He always gets rejected like this. He feels like nobody likes him, right? And you do all that stuff and sort of almost build up the energy, like what you're feeling, and then you switch it to the second person. And you say, who are you? Right? And then generally I get some kind of an image or a memory will sort of form for me, and it'll show me. And it's not always a child either. Sometimes it's adult. Like there's that when I was in a hermit basically for those 11 years, 100 pounds heavier, and just really that guy comes out a lot in my inner child work whenever I feel like an imposter. Whenever I feel like I shouldn't be, I don't have any business writing. I don't have any business telling people about inner child. I shouldn't be doing this at all. That guy comes out because he's like, we're just a failure. We're just, there's no reason to do this stuff. So, I mean, depending on the trigger, depending on the situation. And last year I traveled all year. I went all through Southeast Asia, right? If you're looking for new triggers and to find more about yourself, go travel. Like you get have a run-in with the immigration guys, or like you lose your credit card and all this stuff. The child just kept flying up, and I love it when that happens. I avoid terms like childish or immature, and I just think the term childlike. When I'm feeling childlike, that's an opportunity for me to really tap into the core of what made me, and also, the part that was not me. We learn so much from our caregivers and other people about how we're supposed to be. But and when your caregivers are unhealthy, which mine were, and a lot of people's are, and then we get these unhealthy senses of what's right and wrong. And when we do the, when we do the inner work and the spiritual work, then we start to find our own integrity. And that's what happened with me. I started to realize what I really believe in and what I really care about. And so that really made me healthier than I ever thought I could be.
How did you? It sounds like you found it really difficult in recovery in the beginning, and obviously you'd kind of worked through all the codependency stuff. What made you start looking at the inner child work? What got you to that point?
The codependency, you mean the inner child stuff related to
Yeah. So what
codependency?
led you to that? Because that sounds like that's the part where you started to then heal, if I'm right in saying that.
I think I was starting to heal before that because I was doing a lot of work to address the dependency, the alcohol, the drugs, and all that. And I was getting better, but I was getting kind of stunted by the codependency that was kind of eating at me. But I was doing a lot of emotional and spiritual work even at that time. But just specifically inner child, I think I got from reading the Codependence Anonymous book. And then I was curious about it. And then I have a really dear friend who actually wrote the not the
I
dedication. I
read that.
dedicated the book to her. Yeah, and she wrote the foreword. And so we did outreach, and she's also a big inner child person. Actually, she mentioned it to me first. I think she was doing it before I was doing it. And some other people too. And a lot of my friends in Tokyo too, I was kind of like the original gangster. I was like, what's David doing? What's like codependency stuff? What's his inner child stuff? And so other people were kind of trying it out. And because they saw results in me, you know, and I mean, I saw results in me and they saw results in me. And it can be sort of another level of wellness if you are able to start peeling the onion that much more. Some people don't want to do it. Some people can't. And some people are just, they're just like, okay. They're like, I don't want to do all that. You know, I'm pretty okay. My relationships are not great, but they're not terrible either or whatever, you know, and you know, it's not for everybody. But if you're struggling and your relationships keep blowing up, and that's the thing, like for me, it was like I would have somebody I'd really care about, and then one thing would lead to another, and I'd have a big blow up or a big, like some sort of a passive aggressive thing. I would put up with stuff for a long time because I thought I didn't have a right to have boundaries, and I had to put up with it because I'm not that great anyway, so I'm lucky that they're my friend. These kinds of skewed thinkings would lead to relationships blowing up and losing people. And when I'm trying to like connect, and I'm trying to, especially when you're trying to recover and you're struggling with drugs and alcohol, it's hard enough to connect anyway. And then when you feel like you're not even able to maintain those kind of connections, it's a killer. And that's why I had to address it.
I'm listening to you, David, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't know that everybody needs to sort of have a sort of particularly sort of big backstory to actually benefit from doing
Oh,
the
no.
work that you're talking about. I'm
No.
hearing you, and I'm thinking to myself, I could probably do with doing a bit of this because, and I, you know, my dad sadly passed away when I was in my early 20s, and we,
Oh, sorry.
so I was kind of, relatively young, but I was a lot older obviously than you were in terms of being able to deal with that. But I definitely think that, and then before that, sort of in terms of how we were raised, it was great. It was a loving relationship. My mum and dad were very sort of good people, but it wasn't without its quirks, if you know what I mean. And I guess what I'm trying to drive at is I could probably do with sort of understanding a bit about how I was as a child, how certain events shaped me, and how it made me think, and how it now affects me as a 50 coming up 55-year-old guy, because it definitely does. And it kind of, and you know, we're all, I think when you stop drinking, you start to strive to be the best person that you possibly can be within your own body, if that makes sense. And yet we're
Sure.
always kind of hamstrung a little bit by events of the past or our inner workings. And I think sometimes it's quite healthy to unpick some of that, or at least understand it. Would you agree it is something for everybody, and you don't necessarily need to have a sort of a anything particularly sort of bad in your past to actually be able to benefit from it?
Definitely. I absolutely think that's true. And it can just be a refresher. Like, I mean, you don't have to have a miserable life to do this kind of work. I mean, I think it's really just a self-awareness exercise when you come right down to it. And it's like, and you know, I don't spend my life in the past either. I mean, the point is really to embrace it, integrate it. And then I really like living in the now. So I like riding my bike down to the beach and smelling flowers and hanging with my friends and doing all that kind of stuff. It's not a matter of dwelling, which some people worry that say, I don't want to think about the past so much. It's not healthy. For me, I had to resolve a lot of things and come to like and love myself. So for me, it was pretty involved. But at the same time, I think it's self-awareness, and it's a healthy thing that we can do in order to sort of enrich what's going on now. Because the other thing is, when you do get those, like, you know, everybody gets childlike sometimes, right? You have this, like, you know, petulant whatever, you snap at your significant other, or you have a little, you know, argument with your friends, and you walk away and you say, oh geez, why'd I do that? You know, I shouldn't have done that. And then, but then you end up repeating it, and it's like, well, because it's a stuck pattern. Right? Because we repeat these things that we don't. So if you are able to sort of look into it and be like, oh, that's why, you know, then those things tend to resolve. And for me, then I don't end up doing that quite the same way the next time. And so I'm a better person to be around.
it's useful for anybody to do. When I'm doing coaching, we look at limiting beliefs quite a lot, and that's part of the things that you believe about yourself from when you were younger. And when I did group therapy as well, I found out, and I thought it was really interesting, that often it's your perception of the situation. So, for instance, me, my brother, and my sister all grew up in the same house, but my perception of what was happening was different from what my sister and my brother kind of felt about it. So it's about personality and your feelings. And I think, like David said, you've had to do a lot of work, a lot of deep work, and unpick a lot of stuff. But it doesn't always have to be like that. It could just be, as you say, unpicking little bits about yourself so that you can become the best version of yourself.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree with that. And yeah, it's I think I would love I don't know. I think wellness is something they should teach in schools. Like,
Oh,
honest to God, I think,
100%.
I mean, you think about that, it's about it's how to get along. It's all these kinds of things. Like, if a teacher, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole too much, but if teachers back when I was a kid had been a little bit more aware and a little less condemning, a little more like, I had one teacher, I remember one teacher, he used to say that I was abrasive. And I was like, I was in junior high school. It's like, what do you mean? Like, now thinking back, I'm like, what were you, why not, like, say, oh, you seem to be really struggling. Let's have a conversation with, let's, whatever. I don't know. But like, and I internalized that, like, David, you're abrasive. That's another reason why you're not likable. I believed that for a long time until I realized that that guy was probably mirroring or doing some other thing, because he wasn't the nicest guy.
A lot of the teachers actually don't know. A lot of the teachers have not done stuff. And to have that conversation with you about why are you acting like this, why do you feel like this, would be such an easier piece of work to do than have to deal with a child then hitting out through the years because they've been told they act or
Yeah.
play a certain way.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's certain things from my childhood that stick with me, certain comments that particularly, man, I'm not having a go at him, but dad would say certain things, and he was quite, he had a temper on him, and he would lash out, and he had his own frustrations and anger, and sort of, and I can remember certain things he said, and then you become that person, don't you? You because it's your father telling you that, it's somebody, and you're young, and you're there to learn, and you're being told certain things that stick with you, and that forms your character. And then those,
It does.
clearly your experiences, David, of you turn them into something positive and powerful and use them for good, but they can also take it the other way as well. And there's this internal sort of battle going on inside your head, isn't there? And it's fascinating, this story, and it's kind of going in a direction that I'm really grateful for, because it's making me think about my own sort of my own background. So
Good,
thank you for.
good. I'm glad. No, and I agree. And the thing is, it's not intentional. It's hurt people hurt people. That's one thing you hear a lot, right? And generational trauma, you hear that as well. I talk a lot about my grandmother in the book, who I loved very much, but she implanted a desperate financial insecurity in me because she grew up in the Depression. And she convinced me that I was going to go without my meal, and I was going to, things were going to fall apart, and this and that. And like, I've had such angst and stress about money, and Kelly talking about limiting beliefs. I mean, God, I'm still working on that stuff, believe me. And so, I mean, I've worked really hard. I'm not resentful. I don't believe that I have hard feelings towards anyone. My dad passed away last year, and I feel like I grieved in a pretty healthy way, considering how complex it was. But he still did harm. And the same, and I have a daughter, and I did harm to her. She's 22 now, and thankfully we have a beautiful relationship. That's not always how it goes. But man, she grew up with a drinking dad, a drunk dad. And I did lots of harm, and in some ways more than my dad did. And so, and that's, I didn't do it on purpose, but I still did harm. Same as my dad. Maybe your dad, maybe he was having a bad day, or the stress that he was inappropriately putting onto a kid. I mean, everybody does it. Everybody does it from time to time. I mean, well, you can be a, you're, you know, we're not saints, but at the same time, the awareness helps a lot, because then you can kind of go back and go, oh, whoa, that wasn't really right for me to direct my anger at you. Because actually, I need to deal with my own anger, and I shouldn't. And to be able to apologize to a kid is a big thing, I think. And it's never the kid's fault.
Do you know what I'm just sitting here thinking about? The the damage that alcohol causes, and yet it's so pushed at us at every angle. Because you look at obviously yourself, David, me in recovery, and obviously it got to a stage which was really traumatic. Ian jumped off the train before it got to that stage, or it maybe wouldn't have got to that stage. But what I mean is, if you look at Ian sitting here thinking, oh God, this is really interesting, I'd kind of maybe like to do a bit of work. Nobody sits and thinks things like that when they're drinking. And it's just like you just do not have the clear head, the clarity of mind to sit and think, like, okay, how can I be a better person? I think if we didn't have alcohol in the world, there'd be so many better people because you would have that clear mind to be able to work on yourself and have these conversations. It's frustrating, isn't it? It is.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. I was just coming on to that. Actually, I was just thinking about that, because I think when obviously, you know, you're 8 years alcohol free, as we call it, or sober. What's kind of, can you pick up on some of the things that have kind of elevated in your life in those 8 years? Because you did say before we started recording, you said that you found the first years quite tough, and I'd like to get into that if you don't mind. But before we do that, can you just talk about some of the positives that you can clearly see now that have happened because you've done all this in this deep dive into yourself, but also because you've fundamentally stopped drinking?
My life in every measurable way is better. So, I mean, I can't even list it because it's everything. It's literally everything. First and foremost, my relationship with my daughter. She and we went to see fireworks a few nights ago. She lives with her mom, but very close by. We see each other about once a week, and she's a 22-year-old woman, right? A lot of people in their 20s don't want to see their parents ever. So I feel lucky that she actually wants to spend time with me. That relationship could never have been repaired if not for recovery, if not for everything that went into that, and starting with quitting drinking. And I'm not one that advocates that alcohol, that everybody should quit alcohol or whatever, but I had to. There's no doubt. And I don't do anything risky, like whatever, casually smoke pot or do any other kind of thing that might lead me back that way. But then, okay, besides that, really healthy, loving, deep friendships. I have a bunch of them. And some of this is more codependence related than alcohol. First, I had to get off the substances, and then I had to learn how to, love myself enough to be lovable to others, and respect myself enough to have boundaries and not put up with what we shouldn't put up with. But yeah, I have healthy friendships in my life. I know that I can make more if I need to or want to. I feel like I've got two new friends here today. I'm sure we'll be chatting again. And right, and it's easy for me now. That doesn't mean everybody has to like me, and not everybody likes me, but it's easy for me now to make friends. I couldn't make a friend to save my life for 50 years, and that was so disheartening, and made me angry. I was like, why didn't I get the instruction manual to life? Everybody else has friends, why can't I? So I mean that in itself, my health. I'm just, my physical health, my spiritual, mental, emotional health is all much, much better. It's not perfect. It's a roller coaster. I still have ups and downs, but man, it's better than it was. And I have so much hope for the future too. And things are going, I mean, and I'm writing books now. I'm furthering my career. I'm living where I want to live. What else? I traveled the world last year, all year. I went to Indonesia and played drums with a bunch of kids, and then I went to Thailand and played more drums, and Vietnam, and just how much more could I say? Like, yeah, there you go.
Brilliant.
But
Do you know it?
it didn't come around in one day. It did. It took time, and I did struggle for a long time. So that's, if people are struggling, there's no timeline. I really, yeah, took a long time.
I think if there's one thing that comes for this episode, it'll be hope for people, because when you think of what you've been through and the amount of work you've had to do in those years, isolating must have been, to come back from that is just nothing short of a miracle. So I think the fact that you've got to where you are just now, it'll encourage people to trust the process.
Absolutely. If I could do it, anybody could. I really do believe that. It's funny because I meet people now who are struggling and they don't believe me. They're like, no, you weren't that bad. You couldn't have been that bad. I was like, no, trust me. I introduced them to people who knew me 8, 10 years ago. It's like, you tell them what a train wreck I was. Cause I really was. I was, I 8 years ago, I had a psychiatrist tell me that I was psychotic. This is not my opinion. That's a doctor's opinion, right? And that's okay. There you go. I was literally psychotic and near death in several different ways, near death in a suicidal sense, but I also feel like my physical health was pretty close to done. And yeah, it was, and not everybody makes it. Sad to say, but not everybody makes it. I'm lucky. But yeah, I always had a little bit of hope, even in the dark times, for some reason. I don't know why, but I did. I always did. And so that's the, when I connect with those inner child, they always had some kind of hope. And that's what I kind of say to them too. It's like, hey, look, you did it. Here we are. You got through all that. You're awesome,
You said before that it was tough when you first stopped drinking and started to get sober. It was really tough, and you found it was years really that you actually, things were hard for a while. Do you mind just talking a little bit about that and just sort of how you combated that, how you dealt with it in the time?
Every day. A lot of my recovery is a spiritual thing. So there was that. I had to come around to an idea. So I really hated the idea of God, because why would God take my mom away and screw me like that when I was so little? Right. And it took me a long time to make some kind of peace with these ideas, right? Because like you look at the world and you look at the suffering children and you think, whatever, how could there be? So I had to do a lot of spiritual and emotional work on that, including like addressing my mom's suicide and what that meant and what she must have gone through, all that kind of stuff. So I was not able to have any kind of a spiritual element right off the bat. So even that was a big struggle because I was just like wanted to drink every day. Miserable every day. I was having panic attacks. I don't think I've had a panic. I want to knock on wood somewhere because I don't want to have one today. I haven't had a panic attack in probably 6 or 7 years, but I used to have wicked panic attacks, like really bad. Like I would have, fight or flight. I'd have to get out of that situation. Shame attacks too, which people are less familiar with, but there's also shame attacks, and I had those as well. Which those I can still get, just like we can still get panicky. It can still get shame, but as far as like full on crippling emotional like attacks like that, haven't had that in a long time. But I did in early, what did you say? I said early sobriety, but you said
Yes, that's right.
in
Yes.
early non-drinking.
Yeah.
So that was going on, 1 month, 3 months in, and I was trying to go to work and I was having a panic attack. And if I lost my job, I would have been even more screwed. And it was pretty nightmarish. It really was for a couple of years. Really. And then addressing the codependence was another like couple of years of more, less visceral, less physical, but more emotionally devastating. So it's kind of a, 1-2 punch. It was not easy. And I think my situation's a bit extreme. So I don't want people to think, oh God, what, I have to wait 5 years and then maybe I'll be okay. It's, I mean, there was certainly good times along the way. But I had a lot to recover from, I think.
I think that there's definitely a message there, though, for our listeners that aren't, like you say, it's taken you years because there's a lot happened in your life. But for me, there's a message there to our listeners who are thinking about stopping drinking just now because they've got things happening in their life that's negatively impacting their life due to alcohol. Get off the bus now. Get off the bus and remove alcohol from your life. And it may not take as long to recover. It may, but you've got a better chance of getting through it if you jump off the bus before it gets really, really bad.
I think once you know you have a problem, that's what I think. That's what I advise people if they're asking me. I'm like, do you think you have a problem? Like somebody in their 20s or whatever. Once you know you have a problem, it's never gonna get better. Like at least it in my experience it didn't. And like I can talk for as a person who was in his first rehab in his 20s and then finally quit at age 48. I had ups and downs, but it's just like it's just like a crashing stock market, right? It kind of goes up and down, but the trajectory was just down, just all, and then at a certain point, it was just completely like game over.
You spoke there about obviously your recovery was really hard and you'd a lot of people around you helping you with that. That must have been difficult, kind of asking for that help and being around people when you'd isolated yourself for so long.
Oh my God, yeah. No, I was really, really, what's the word I'm looking for? Desocialized, maybe? It was weird for me to sit in a room with people. I felt like I was at a zoo. Like somebody would like blow their nose or like comb their hair or something. I'm like, this is weird. 'Cause like I was so isolated. I really, I was the weird one because I was just, I think, yeah, desocialized. And I think that's not atypical. 11 years is a long time, but I've heard a lot of stories when you get really low bottom cases. Where you're just out of society. And yeah, it's really tragic. It's sad. But yeah, it was weird. It was like, yeah, but now I hang out. But I'm still for the record, I'm an introvert. I don't do well with crowds. I love people, I really do. But it takes my energy away. And so like even Monday night I went out with friends and like there was more friends than I expected. And I was just kind of like, oh, okay, I was in the corner. You know, I was like, where's the one that I trust the most? I'll hang out with him. You know, so I mean, that's that you don't have to, you just can be yourself. And that's another more self-acceptance right there. Like, I know my limitations. I know when I have to step away. Like, these kinds of things used to make me irritable and I would kind of lash out because I didn't know anything about what was going on inside me.
I'm just going back to the what we talked about when you were saying about how tough it was in the first few years when you did get sober and you stopped drinking. It's kind of, I was 50, oh, sorry, I was 49 when I stopped drinking 6 years ago. So 55 this month. I think that it comes back to this again. It's the inner child thing. There's so many things you bottled up and sort of masked and just covered and tried to forget for so long. Inevitably, when you then do stop in later life, if you know what I mean, for me, it was when I was 49. I suppose it's kind of it stands to reason, doesn't it? That suddenly when you stop sort of masking everything and you actually let things breathe and come out, there's going to be a lot that's going to come out and it's going to take a lot to deal with. And it will take years because it took years to get to that point that you were. So it's kind of inevitable, I guess, to a degree, but you don't anticipate that really, do you? And you've got to be patient and it's a bit of a roller coaster, isn't it, David?
Absolutely, it is. And I still have inner child facets come out even now that like really shocked me. There's a couple, I ended up back in Japan under fairly strange circumstances. And I was felt very safe here. Like I lived here for a long time and I was finally able to sort of be off the road and feeling safe. And suddenly, these are actual events that happened to me, two runaways. I ran away from home at age like 10 and then again like age like 13. And it was really, I mean, like I was taking the train, like going to my grandparents' house, trying to get to my grandparents' house by train through Boston, Massachusetts. And like people were like, "What are you doing, little boy? Like you're supposed to be on this train." I'm like, "Oh yeah, no, I'm cool." You know, and actually I forgot all about it. And the thing is, 'cause like bigger things happened when I was a kid. So like I forgot about that. And like, but that little 10-year-old, he felt in danger. He knew, like, you know, riding around in the on a Boston subway train, it's getting dark, you know. And actually I did, I got lost. And that inner child only came out like a month ago due to the circumstances and realizing like that I had been feeling insecure. And when I was traveling around Southeast Asia, like, what if I get lost? What if I die? What if I get killed? You know, these kinds of things. That happened and it just got sort of swept up, you know, and that inner child like waited patiently because it was like not high on the priority list, which is sad to say. But I mean, yeah, I mean, unpacking this stuff takes a lifetime, maybe. You know, I assume it will, but it's kind of, it's a lot easier now and it's not an everyday thing. It's as circumstances. You know, it's funny when a funny, strange new circumstance comes up. That's when something will come out for me.
Kelly, I've loved this chat today. So it was this morning. I didn't
Me too.
anticipate this. Thank you so much, David. It's been so
It's been
enlightening
amazing.
and thought-provoking.
No.
And I hope we've done you justice, if you know what I mean, because your story and your what you've where you've come from and where you are now, From this side of the water, sometimes sort of distance helps a story, if you know what I mean. And I think us being in a very different sort of part of the world, I think it's almost helped amplify your story, if you know what I mean. So thank you very much for reaching out and speaking to us today.
Oh,
And
thank
I
you.
downloaded your book on Kindle this morning, so I'm absolutely, I mean, I downloaded it and read the kind of first part, but I'm really looking forward to getting into it now. You've gave me a lot of food for thought today.
I hope
Where
you
can people
enjoy
get
it.
your
Yeah.
book?
You can just go to the website daviddeanhaskell.com, and that's where you can get all my books. But I'm in the process of, this is my cool podcasting mic here, and I'm in the process of doing the audiobook with my own voice. That'll be out pretty soon, like within a month or so, and you should be able to get that attached to the ebook for very cheap. So you'll get to hear my awesome voice doing
Amazing.
it. So
Brilliant.
I'll probably, by the time it's released, I probably won't have finished the book because it takes me forever to read books. I'm more an audiobook person. So I'll probably read
Okay.
a bit of it and then jump onto the audio. So
Okay, well, I'll
hopefully
send you a
that.
message about that. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed today, David. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to reach out to us and talking to openly about your story as well. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank
Yeah.
you, thank you, thank
Thanks
you.
so
You guys
much,
are
David. It's
great.
been really great.
Thank you.
We always wrap up our podcast, David, by doing a bit of self-promo, don't we, Kelly? So, how if people have been sort of have really enjoyed the openness and honesty of today's chat, there's loads of this goes on within the alcohol and censored community, isn't there, Kelly?
Yeah,
Do you mind just
there
telling
is.
people who are listening maybe for the first time a bit about us and a bit about how they can get in touch with us?
Yeah, I think, well, today's conversation is kind of a little insight in what goes on in the community in terms of it doesn't matter your drinking story, it doesn't matter how much you drink, how often you drink, it's about how it makes you feel. And within our community, there's people from all walks of life, from all points of the scale on the kind of their drinking habits. And within there, it's just encouragement and connection. David talks about being isolated for all those years and then coming out and sitting in a room full of people. And that's when you start to grow and learn about yourself and make friends, make proper friends. So if you'd like to give it a go, we've got Zooms every single day of the week at different times. We've got a mobile app with a forum in there where you can chat to people. And I'm so keen to get people to try it, just to give it a go and see what it's like, because I know a lot of people are apprehensive. So if you want to try it and you can pop in there for 2 weeks, free of charge, no obligation to join us, just send me a message and I'll set you up with access so that you can jump on a Zoom and chat to people or have a little nosy about the forum and see the kind of the support and the friendships that go on in there. And if you want to get in touch, it's team@alcoholuncensored.co.uk.
And if you do want to join, it's £20 a month, and you can cancel when you want. So it's small beer, as they say. That'll be a phrase lost on you, David. It means it's very little. And the irony is, we're referring to beer. But there you go. David, enjoy the rest of your day in Japan. Great to meet you, and hopefully, our paths will cross again soon with a bit of luck.
Yes, thank you. Let's
Thanks,
do it
David.
again. Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
everyone.
Have a good
Bye.
day, everybody. Take
Bye.
care.